We're continuing this series of the You're Invited. You know, the question is what is God inviting us into? A few weeks ago, we looked at the story of Mary and Martha and the fact that God was inviting us into his presence, that he was inviting Mary and Martha to be at his feet, to be discipled by him. And the idea of just, that's where we start. We start in God's presence. We start at his feet to listen to his words. This week, we're going to look at one of my favorite stories that Jesus tells in the Bible. Jesus often used, it's found in the Gospel of Luke, it's chapter 15. Jesus used stories or parables often to convey deep and profound truths. The stories were always memorable, and it helped to connect people with the deep ways that would help the message of Jesus come to life and be remembered. Parables are micro stories that Jesus shares to demonstrate a colossal truth. So don't take them as just like, oh, Jesus just told a random story for no reason. They are micro stories, they're small stories that gives us a glimpse into a colossal truth. The fact that in chapter 15 in Luke, Jesus gives three parables back to back to back was unique in his teaching. Normally, he might share one story, but this time he uses three. And the fact that he uses three is significant, and it emphasizes the message that he wants to convey. It's to get to the heart and make sure that there was no misunderstanding this time, because sometimes Jesus would tell a parable and you're like, I don't quite understand what he's telling us. And he used these three stories to really drill down, this is what I'm talking about. And just in case you're not clear, I'm going to tell you another one. And just in case you're not clear, I'm going to tell you another one. And each story builds on the significance of the message that Jesus was talking about. In chapter 15, verse 1, it sets the stage on who Jesus is talking to. It says this, tax collectors and other notorious sinners often came to listen to Jesus teach. I don't want to gloss over that. Tax collectors and other notorious, I like the word, that's what the New Living Translation uses, notorious sinners. I feel like I'm a notorious sinner. But they often came to listen to Jesus teach. This made the Pharisees and the teachers of religious law complain that he was associating with such sinful people, even eating with them. How dare he eat with them? So Jesus has been teaching for a while. He's been going from town to town, place to place, and he has been spending time with the lowest of the low, the notorious, the people that are nefarious that nobody wants anything to do with. That's who Jesus is hanging out with. He's spending time with them, and more so, he is eating with them, which culturally was a significant relational step in with other people, to break bread with somebody, to invite somebody into your home or to be with them. Like that speaks more than just a handout or just talking or passing them in the street. This is a desire to have a deep and personal relationship with those people. And so that's what Jesus has been doing. And all those people are on the outside, these Pharisees and these religious leaders who are coming along and they're watching Jesus do this and they're like, how dare you? Like, you're not a teacher, you're not a rabbi, you're not somebody who knows the Bible, who because you're associating with people that aren't worth the time of day. And yet that's who Jesus is hanging out with. And so these three parables are Jesus talking specifically to the Pharisees and the teachers of the law on why he's doing what he's doing. And again, it's significant because he wants to really drill home the point. The first two parables, the parable of the lost sheep and the lost coin, have the same message. How important something that was lost was to the person who lost it. We see the shepherd who has 100 sheep and one goes astray, one wanders off. And so he leaves those 99 and he goes after that one sheep because it's important to him. And he returns it joyfully. He puts it on his shoulders and he carries it back, rejoicing that he found his sheep. The lost coin is a woman who has 10 coins that are obviously the coins, and these are coins that have extreme value. It's more than just it's not a nickel. This is like gold pieces. These are significant coins. They all have value, and she loses one in her house. And back then, those houses were dirt floors, and they were dark. They didn't have very good lighting. They relied on a lot of sunlight. And she breaks out a lamp and she searches the house and through the dusty floors to find what is kind of an impossible thing to find, which is this one coin. But it has value and worth, and so she goes after it and pursues it until it's returned to her. And she rejoices. And then it brings us to the story we're going to focus on this morning, which is the parable of the lost son. It's setting the stage for Jesus to talk about two brothers and a father's deep love. We're gonna come back to the older brother's side of the story at another point. So we're gonna focus really on the father and the younger son, who most of the story is. Let's look at the word together, starting in verse 11. To illustrate the point further, Jesus told them this story. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, "I want my share of your inheritance or your estate now before you die." So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. A few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings and moved to a distant land. And there he wasted all his money in wild living. About the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. The younger man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him. But no one would give him anything. Let's pause there. We see this picture of a son who's unhappy and wants to leave. And so he's going to leave home. I don't think it's just a case of a son wanting to go make his own way and to leave his family. I actually think this is a radical rejection for the son who leaves home. It's more than just leaving home. The way he left is significant because as Jesus is telling the story, I am sure that all the people that were listening felt the weight of what was happening. Because for a son to demand his inheritance before the father has passed away is the equivalent of saying, "I want you dead. I want nothing to do with you ever again. Give me what's mine, and I want nothing to do with you." He's rejecting his father. He's rejecting his place in the family. And he's saying, I want none of this. It's as if he is wishing his father was dead. I was looking at other cultures, kind of examining this text, and an author I was looking at, he's from a Chinese upbringing, and his perspective on this was so interesting because he just said that, like, there's no chance this would ever happen in a Chinese home. Like, if you dishonored your family to that point, like, the father would be grabbing that son and tossing him back into his room, and it'd be the end of the story. This wouldn't happen. But that's not what the father did. The father actually really deeply loved his son, so he gave him his inheritance early, sent him away, or let him go. And not only that, but the son, it's a complete departure from his identity. It's not that he just wanted his father dead and wanted this money and this wealth, wanted those things, those possessions. He went off into a distant land. He went as far away from his family as he could get so that there was no chance that he could be connected back to his family. It's a complete rejection of his birthright. It's a complete rejection of his true identity. He wanted nothing to do with it. I'm out. I'm leaving. I'm going to a distant land. But it's not an ancient story. This isn't just a story that Jesus tells that's for that time. It's our story too. We may not physically leave home or reject our family or our identity, but we all kind of have distant lands. Places where we want to distance ourselves from our heavenly Father. We demand our inheritance. We go to God and we say, I'll take your blessing. Give me good health. Give me the talents. Give me the abilities to go pursue my own things. Give me the ability to live this life well, to be able to earn money, to be able to be creative, to be able to have relationships, to pursue love, but I don't want you. Our distant lands become chasing wealth as our security instead of trusting God's provision, seeking power and control instead of surrendering to God's will, craving admiration and validation from others instead of resting in God's love, building our identity on achievement instead of on being God's beloved children. And we see the son goes to this distant land and he quickly wasted all his money in wild living. I'm like, I don't even know what to picture there. Other than that term wasted, the original word actually means scattered. Like seeds thrown into the wind. He's pursuing these things on his own. He's trying to find wealth and validation and love and admiration. He's trying to find a place on his own away from his father and his name and his family. He's searching for fulfillment. Does this resonate at all? And then it's interesting because a great famine sweeps over the land. And in that moment, he gets to a place of brokenness. Because all of those pursuits that he's been pursuing now are being magnified by the famine that's happening in the land. The walls are kind of coming crashing in. He's feeling the weight of his decisions and the pursuits that have not found fulfillment for him. The external circumstances expose our internal spiritual bankruptcy. Sometimes we find success and we think, okay, if I just find wealth, And I just achieve this status in my job that, okay, I'm going to find fulfillment. And we get there, and then all of a sudden it just feels empty. So it's not always like this son where it just the walls come crashing in and you're left with nothing. You could actually have everything that you've been pursuing, but when you're pursuing it apart from the Father, all of a sudden it starts to feel empty. The walls start coming in. We start to feel like we start to search for other ways to find fulfillment because it's not enough. The money is not enough. We need more money, or we need more power, or we need more attention. And so we start trying to find that. Love, the love that we're pursuing isn't enough, so we start to look at unhealthy ways. And pretty soon, these pursuits that once were maybe noble in the eyes of the world become secret and dark. They become addictions. They become lustful things. They become things where we put our faith and our trust in something that is fleeting and can go away. And then what happens is interesting. For the son, he gets to this spiritual bankruptcy, he gets to this broken place, and he ends up feeding pigs. That may not sound like a big deal, but it's a big deal. Because here's a Jewish man, and in that time, the Jews considered pigs to be the most unclean animal that you don't have anything to do with, you don't come into contact with. If you come into contact with a pig, or even the mud that the pig is in, you are considered unclean and dirty. It's interesting how when we're not finding fulfillment, or we get to a place where we've achieved what we were pursuing, and we start feeling empty, and so we start looking for other ways to pursue happiness, other ways to pursue admiration or wealth, that we were willing to compromise. Our compromise takes us to places we never thought we would go. So here's a man who's broken, and now he's compromising not only his identity, but he's compromising his faith. He's compromising the very core of who he is by feeding pigs and even thinking that their food sounds better than his own. He spent his time pursuing things, especially in this world that are good, that people say are good. The world says these things are good. It's good to pursue a career. It's good to go to college and get a degree. It's good to get money and to have a house and to have expensive cars. It's good to be liked by people. It's good to have a lot of followers on social media, and we see it if you're on Facebook and you see people just posting all the really good things about their life, and you're found, I got to compete with my neighbor. I got to compete with my friend. I got to show all the good things I'm doing, the trips I'm taking. Because that's what the world is pressing in. Like, this is where you're going to find happiness. Come to the world. Come be a part of this stuff. But what happens is when you get to that place, that dark place where you start to compromise and you start to make exceptions to try to find fulfillment, and it turns into that anger and resentment and compromising where your addiction, all those kinds of pieces, the world isn't there to help you out. You're not going to get bailed out. It says in verse 16, no one gave him anything. He had nothing. And so here he is. He's at rock bottom. But I want to say this. Rock bottom isn't punishment. It's an invitation. This is the invitation, because it's in that place of desperation that something beautiful begins to happen. Let's keep reading in verse 17. When he finally came to his senses, I like that, like he had another choice. He said to himself, at home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare. And here I'm dying of hunger. I will go home to my father and say, Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant. I'm going to pause again. Notice what's happening. He has hit bottom. He's at a place of desperation, and he begins to recognize that what he's missing is he's missing his father. He's missing his home. And so he decides to act. He starts to make his way home, but he recognizes that he's rejected his father. So to go home to his father, he's expecting to be disowned. He's expecting to be rejected. So he's trying to work out in his head, how do I get back to my father's house? How do I get back to the place that I belong? And he starts to come up with a new plan. I'll go home and I'll ask, maybe I can just be a hired servant. Maybe I can just be one of the hired hands that works for my father. That's going to be better because I'll at least be in the father's house. And so he heads home. And all the way home, here's a man who's walking along and he's rehearsing his entire speech, word for word, what he's going to say to his father. And he's thinking to himself, if I just say the right words, maybe I can earn my way back into my father's house. Like, how can I convince him to at least let me be a hired servant, a hired hand? How often do we think of our relationship with God as something we have to work for? We have to earn. If I just work hard enough to do the right thing, if I just try to love my neighbor well enough, if I just try to be kind enough at work, if I just pray more, if I read my Bible more, volunteer more, if I do enough good things, then maybe God will take me back. Maybe I can be home. That's not God's invitation to us. This is the beautiful part. Here's where we discover what God's grace really looks like. What we're being invited into. The Son has a plan on how he's going to get back home. How he's going to get back into the Father's house. But watch the Father's response. Let's pick up verse 20. So he returned home to his father, and while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming, filled with love and compassion. He ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. His son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son." But his father said to the servants, "Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. And kill the calf we have been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast. For this son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found." So the party began. The story is obviously focusing on the son who was lost and returns, and it's had many names. It's the parable of the lost son. It's the prodigal son returns. N.T. Wright has what I think is the better title for this, which is the running father. Because here's a broken, defeated, devastated lost son, journeying back home, expecting the very worst, expecting to be disowned, expecting to be rejected, expecting the most he could hope for is that he would be a hired hand. about what was actually happening in that moment. The father was waiting day after day, night after night. Instead of working, the father was sitting at the, I can just imagine the father is at the fence, at the property line, and he is just looking out at the horizon. He's being patient. He's quiet, unwavering, looking and searching for his son. This is profound for us. God isn't surprised by our return. He's been anticipating it. This isn't a God who gives up on us, but one who never stops waiting and watching for us. And we see this father running to his son. Again, the cultural significance here is important. You would never see a man of this stature with this amount of money and wealth and property ever run. Dignified men didn't run. They walked with measured steps. But the father's love is undignified. He will run through anything to get to his son. Grace doesn't wait for our perfect apology or perfect work or perfect appearance. Grace runs towards us while we were still far off. God doesn't wait for us to clean up our act first. He meets us in our mess. The Father, the people around, we see it with the elder son a little bit. I don't want to get into his story today. But the people around might have looked at this father as being naive. Like, you're a sucker. You got to see the son prove that he's worth coming back to you. But here's a father who sees his son's condition and embraces him before hearing any kind of plan or speech. Don't miss the fact that the son starts his rehearsed speech. Word for word, he's going through the motions. Father, he says, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. But before he could go on to the next part, which is asking to be a servant, the father cuts him off. And what does he do? He calls his servants to bring a robe, ring, and sandals. The robe was asked for because it covered his son's shame, the guilt. You could see the son is wearing tattered, broken clothes. He's lost weight. He looks dirty and filthy. And he goes and he brings the finest linen robe and he wraps it around his son and covers him, restoring the son's dignity. He asks for a ring. The ring is a symbol of authority in the family. He is not a servant. He is still his son. He hasn't lost anything. He hasn't lost his position with his father. And so that he's given this ring. And then finally the sandals. Slaves went barefoot. Sons wore shoes. We see this picture of the son being fully restored into his identity of who he is in his family with his father. And I love that after doing that, the next thing is that they celebrate. They party. It says, so the party began. God wants to celebrate our return to him. He is patient, and when we turn to him, he comes running. I love that picture so much. As I've just thought about this story, and just as being a father, watching my daughter grow up and seeing her go through struggles and things that are hard sometimes, and seeing her go through something difficult, and she's upset. And my first instinct is, and she's, you know, she's mad at herself. She blew it, didn't do something right or whatever. And I just want to go and I just want to run to her and wrap my arms around her and just hold her close. The thing about the parables are that when Jesus tells them, they're fictional stories, but they're based on true people. It's like the names have been changed to protect the innocent. This Father is our Heavenly Father. I'm flawed. I'm broken as a father. I make mistakes because I do sometimes go to my daughter and say, "I should have done this differently," or "What did you learn?" But this is a picture of what a true father does. Says, "You don't have to fix these things. We'll worry about that stuff later. I want to restore you and bring you back, and I want to celebrate with you your return." The celebration reveals God's heart of just how much he loves his son. Verse 23, we must celebrate with a feast. God doesn't just tolerate our return, he throws a party. The heavens rejoice over one sinner who repents. This isn't just forgiveness, it's jubilation. God's joy isn't about our performance. It's about relationship being restored. This invitation is extended to each of us. Maybe you've been living in your own distant land. You've been chasing wealth and power, position, love, approval. Maybe you've hit your own rock bottom. Maybe you've achieved those things, and now you're sitting there going, "What's next?" Or what you thought was enough isn't enough anymore, and so you're finding yourself compromising. You're finding yourself in addiction. You're finding yourself turning to things you never would have thought, and if you were to tell other people about it, you would feel so much shame and guilt. Maybe you're feeling that shame and guilt. You've hit rock bottom, but you're ready to come home. And that's the beautiful truth, is that you don't have to clean yourself up first. God's grace is enough. He's inviting you into his grace. You don't have to earn your way back. Grace runs toward you while you are still far off. It's about turning to Jesus, to the Father, letting him do the work. We're going to move into a time of response for us. We're going to go back to worship and a time of communion. I'm going to invite the worship team. They're already coming. I was just looking at Kevin, who was sitting. As we move into this time to respond, I just want to start by saying this, is that God is inviting you back home. that his message is a message of salvation. It's saving you, restoring you back to your rightful spot and place in the Father's arms. That salvation comes because of Jesus' death and resurrection. Because of his death and resurrection, we now have that path home. We don't have to rehearse a speech. We don't have to come up with a plan. We just have to turn, and Jesus points the way. In fact, the cross shows us just how far God was willing to run to bring us back. This isn't just about getting to heaven someday. This is about coming home to the Father's grace and his love, his extravagant love today. As we move into communion, I want you to think about the bread that represents Christ's body that was broken. And as you dip it into the juice, which represents his blood that was poured out, think about how they represent God's extravagant grace, his deep love, and how far he ran to bring you home. You need to know that you are a beloved son, a treasured daughter who is deeply and dearly loved by the Father. You are not just forgiven. You are not just restored. You are celebrated and welcomed home with joy.